This is a production of Cornell University.
Good evening and welcome to the final of the summer session lecture series. Before we begin, I want to give a couple of thank yous. Katie Heine, in addition to all the other duties she has had over the years, has been just a tremendously able events manager. Katie has spent 10 summers doing that, and she's decided this will be her last summer. She's retiring in January so that she can have a summer to herself. So I wish you would stand up, Katie, and give her a hand, please. And also, again, thanks to Catherine Boer and the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences for allowing us to use this wonderful hall. Robert Morgan has taught courses in American literature, modern poetry, and autobiography, as well as poetry and fiction writing since 1971 at Cornell University, where he is the Kappa Alpha Professor of English. The author of 14 books of poetry, Bob has also published 9 volumes of fiction, including Gap Creek, an Oprah Winfrey Book Club selection, and a New York Times bestseller. And it's also on the Oprah Winfrey Book Club list of best books. I don't know what she calls that, but in any case. His most recent novel, Chasing the North Star, won the 2017 Southern Book Award for Historical Fiction. In addition, Bob is the author of 3 nonfiction books, Good Measure, Essays, Interviews, and Notes on Poetry, Boone, a Biography, and Lions of the West, Heroes and Villains of the Westward Expansion. He's also working on a book called Indomitable, Women of the Western Frontier, and that may be available in 2018, but certainly in 2019, and I would recommend that based on our dinner conversation. Bob has been awarded the James G. Haynes Poetry Prize by the Fellowship of Southern Writers and the Academy Award in Literature by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. In 2013, he received the History Award Medal from the Daughters of the American Revolution, recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim and Rockefeller Foundations, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the New York State Arts Council. He has served as a visiting writer at Davidson College, Furman, Duke, Appalachian State, and East Carolina universities. A member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers, he was inducted into the North Carolina Literary Hall of Fame in 2010. Born in Hendersonville, North Carolina, on October 3, 1944, Bob grew up on his family's farm in the Green River Valley of the Blue Ridge Mountains. He wrote his first story in 6th grade, and he continued to write during his teen years. But this was the era of Sputnik and the need to beat the Russians. Although he left high school at 16 without a diploma, because of his high SAT scores, Emory University accepted him as an engineering major. From Emory, he transferred to North Carolina State University, still majoring in engineering. When a glitch in the system kept him out of a class in differential equations, he substituted a class in creative writing with a professor named Guy Owen. That switch altered the course of his life. Professor Owen came into class one day with a story Bob had written about visiting his great-grandmother in an old house in the mountains and said, "When I read this story, I wept." Bob has written, quote, "None of my math teachers had ever said anything like that. From that moment on, I was hopelessly hooked and addicted to writing." Bob Morgan, Chasing the North Star.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here. I love this auditorium. I don't think I've spoken at it. I've attended many events here. Tonight I will be talking about Chasing the North Star, my most recent novel. I had three ideas when I began working on this book. One, I wanted to write a novel set in southern Appalachia that included slavery. I didn't know another Appalachian writer who had addressed that subject. Slavery was not as common in the mountains as it was in the lowlands, in the Piedmont, and in the Deep South, but it was certainly there. And I wanted to tell a story set in the 19th century that included something about slavery in the southern mountains. I also wanted to write a work of fiction that included some scenes in Ithaca, New York, because all my fiction, or almost all my fiction, is set in the South, particularly in the southern Appalachian Mountains. And I had one other inspiration. My dad used to tell me a story about a subject named Little Willie. My great-great-grandparents, Daniel and Sarah Pace, were sitting down to supper in the 1850s in their farmhouse in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina with their son Frank, my great-grandfather, and they heard a noise outside. Frank lit a lantern and went out on the porch to see what was going on. And there were four African Americans, obviously escaped slaves, exhausted. And they asked for something to drink, some water. My great-great-grandparents gave them, I guess, whatever they had to eat, probably cornbread and sweet potatoes, something like that. And as they were eating, they heard the bounty hunter's dogs in the distance. The little boy, two men, one woman, a little boy. The woman pushed the little boy toward my great-great-grandmother and said, "Willie can't run no more." He had injured a leg, and he really couldn't run. And they ran off into the darkness. My great-great-grandmother, I guess, could think fast. She took that little boy and put him in the meal barrel behind the kitchen, covered him with a tow sack, sprinkled meal on it, and the bounty hunters came and threatened them and did search the house. It was a serious crime to aid runaway slaves after the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850. They didn't find the little boy. But then my ancestors had this problem. What are they going to do? I mean, here's this little boy, runaway slave. They doctored his leg and it began to heal. They kept him hidden. And again, my great-great-grandmother came up with the idea of putting him in the wagon with lots of produce. Every year they took hams, honey, molasses, other things down to Greenville, South Carolina, about 30 miles away, and peddled it door to door. They did that, they sold their produce and put little Willie on the wagon as they came back up the mountain, and they told their neighbors they had bought him. It was the only way they could think to protect him. They were waiting for his people to come back for him. They never did. They never knew if they were killed, were caught and sent back to Georgia. Did they make it to Canada? They never found out. My great-great-grandmother made Willie a blue jacket, which he was very fond of. Sometime later, I don't know exactly how long later, in the 1850s, they were out cutting trees on the hill above the spring, and it got hot. Willie took off his jacket, laid it on the leaves, and later he saw a tree was about to fall on the jacket, and he ran to grab the jacket. His foot slipped, the tree fell on him and killed him. When I was a boy, my dad would show me the grave in the family cemetery, the Pace Cemetery, where little Willie was buried. There was a stone there, it wasn't a carved stone, and a blue jar where my great-great-grandmother had put flowers on the anniversary of his death every year. sometime after I came to Cornell, the road around that cemetery was bulldozed, and they bulldozed over that grave. But after I published Chasing the North Star and published an account of Little Willie, my relatives there decided to erect a monument to Little Willie. And we just had the ceremony a week ago, Sunday. And I spoke and read some of that account that I had written of him. So there's now a monument for, we never knew his last name. We just called Willie. Anyway, I thought tonight I would read some short passages from the novel to give you a sense of the narration. It's about an 18-year-old slave on a plantation in Upper South Carolina, just below the North Carolina line, who decides he has to run away. And his sections are in third person. The novel alternates between third person and first person with the character Angel. And this is the way it begins. He was called Jonah because he was born in a terrible storm. And his mama said, soon as she let go of him and put him ashore in this world of folly and time, the thunder quieted and the wind laid. Trees had broken off their stumps and skipped across fields like dust brooms, and the Saluda River spread wide over the bottomlands. Some of the slave cabins behind Mr. Williams' brick house got smashed to splinters by the high tempest. But soon as Jonah was cut loose and washed off in a pan and wrapped in a towel rag, his mama said the sky cleared, and the moon came out and shined so bright you could see a needle in the light from the window. Everything the storm had ruined was vivid in the moonlight, including the dead birds that had been torn from their roots, their roosts, and snakes washed out of holes in the ground. Because Jonah arrived on the full of the moon in the middle of a storm under the sign of the crab, his mama called him her moon baby. The granny woman that delivered him said he would always be darting away, running from one thing and then another. He'd be no more dependable than Jonah in the holy book. Now, Jonah is taken into the house to be the servant to the two children of the owner, Mr. Williams, Mr. and Ms. Williams. And because he sits in on their lessons, he learns to read. And he loves to read. And one day, he wants to get the book he's heard the tutor reading, Robinson Crusoe, and he goes to the library, puts the book inside his shirt, and is trying to escape out the side door. Now remember, slaves were not supposed to be able to read. It was Ms. Williams who caught him taking a book from the master's library. It was a big book called Robinson Crusoe, and he had listened to the tutor read that volume to Betsy and Johnny. It was a thrilling book with lots of words Jonah didn't understand. Day after day, he listened to the tutor reading from that story, and when the book was taken back to the library, Jonah promised himself he was going to slip it under his shirt and carry it back to the cabin to read himself by firelight. Jonah knew where the book was. He'd replaced it on the shelf himself between smooth leather volumes with gold lettering on them. He had no trouble finding the book again. And sliding it inside his shirt, he hoped to walk quickly down the hallway and take the side door out of the house. He would hide the book in a boxwood until nightfall. But just as he passed the dining room, Ms. Williams called to him from the bottom of the stairs. She wanted him to carry a message to her friend Ophelia, who lived on the adjoining farm. She often called Jonah to deliver letters, but almost instantly she spotted the book under Jonah's shirt where the volumes wait, pulled down the fabric. "What is that?" Ms. Williams said and pointed to the sagging cloth. "Ain't nothing, ma'am." "Don't lie to me," Ms. Williams snapped. She made Jonah draw the book from his shirt and hand it to her. "I won't have a thief in my house," his mistress said. Jonah wanted to tell her he was borrowing the book for the tutor, but he knew the tutor would say he'd already read the book to Betsy and Johnny. You were going to take the book to the store and try to sell it, Ms. Williams said. Jonah shook his head and began to cry. He didn't mean to cry, but his knees shook and his jaw trembled. He had no choice but to say he was borrowing the book to read himself. As he said the words, he felt something hot and wet running down his pants leg. He looked at the floor and saw a puddle of pee growing on the varnished planks. Miss Williams noticed the streak down his jeans and the puddle also. Shame on you, Jonah, she said. Shame on you for deceiving us, for stealing a volume from Mr. Williams' library. Miss Williams was young and fat and soft, and she smelled like face powder and perfume. She took a handkerchief from the pocket of her dress and wiped his cheeks. She put her hands on Jonah's shoulders and looked him in the eyes. I won't tell anybody you can read, she said. I won't tell anybody if you'll promise me. Will you promise me? Jonah nodded that he would promise her whatever she asked. He was trembling and afraid he might be whipped and put in chains and branded the way old Isaac was. If a slave fought and hurt another slave, he was whipped and put in chains, even worse. Jonah was afraid he might be sold and sent away to live among strangers. Miss Williams said she'd tell nobody he could read if Jonah would return the book to the library and read to her from the Bible from time to time. She said he'd benefit most from reading the good book, and she was going to give him his very own Bible so he could study it and learn more. Miss Williams has headaches, and she likes to lie with a damp cloth on her forehead and listen to him read to her. It's their secret. Nobody else knows about it. And she gives him this fancy Bible of his own, and she gives him newspapers, ostensibly to start fires back in the quarters. But of course, he reads the newspapers, and reading the newspapers, he learns about geography and the fugitive slave law, and slaves escaping to the north and the North Star. He's caught reading a little bit later in the barn loft on a rainy day while Ms. Williams is away in Flat Rock, just about 20 miles north of there. The master comes up looking for some leather to make a break for a wagon and sees him with these books, accuses him of stealing the Bible. He recognizes the Bible, it had belonged to his wife, and a copy of David Copperfield that had been published the year before. This is 1851. And he says he has to be whipped to teach him a lesson. This is so humiliating to Jonah, he decides later he has to run away because he'll always be called a thief, that he's been caught and whipped. His idea is that if he escapes in the night and runs up the southern Appalachian chain, maybe nobody can find him and he can make his way to the north. He knows a little bit about geography. He's seen maps. So he runs away in the middle of the night, makes his way across the mountains to the headwaters of the French Broad River, steals a boat, goes down the river, and parks it on the bank near Asheville, North Carolina. During the night, he hears the sound on the mountain above the river, and he sees lights, and he goes to find out what is there, and he discovers a group of the local slaves have slipped away in the middle of the night to have a party, to get away from their masters and their work. They call it a jubilee. And I think this was the greatest accident that happened for me writing this, as he discovers this young woman named Angel, who is the concubine or the bed warmer for her master at a plantation near Asheville, North Carolina. She says, "My name is Angel, but I ain't no angel." She tells her own story, and I thought I would just read the passage where she hears first about the jubilee, which her mother attends. I first wrote these sections in dialect, and my editor said he thought that would be hard for people to read. I worked a long time on that dialect, So I rewrote it in perfectly plain grammatical English and explained at the end of the novel that she has learned to read and write. She says, "The first time I heard the word jubilee must be when I was young and Mama went off and left me in the middle of the night. I woke up in the dark and saw Mama standing in the moonlight coming to the window, wrapping a cloth around her head. 'Where are you going?' I said. 'Shh,' Mama said, 'don't wake the little ones.' Then Mama whispered she was going to jubilee, but she'd be back. She said if I didn't lie down and go to sleep again, she'd whip me with a hickory stick come morning. I lay down and closed my eyes and smelled the rose petals Mama gathered by the hedge in front of the big house. She'd crush the petals between her hands and rub them over her neck and shoulders and breasts. There was a murmuring outside when Mama went out the door, and I heard footsteps and laughing and people walking away from the quarters. I lay in the dark thinking about the name Jubilee and what it meant. It must be special because Mama seemed excited, fixing herself up in the middle of the night like she was going to a revival meeting. When I opened my eyes, the moonlight was streaming down from the window, moving slowly so as not to wake up my brothers and sisters. I climbed off the cot and stood in the pool of light. The moonlight seemed to be calling to me, 'Come out and see the world now. Night is the time to play and be happy.' When I opened the door and stepped outside, I saw it was true. The moonlight made the ground clean, coating everything with blue velvet and blue frost. I held up my hands to the moon, and the moon said, 'Look what can be.' I looked at the pine woods and the mountains beyond the woods, and there were blue and silky. They were all the way to where the stars reached down to the ridge beyond the river. I felt like I could walk on that carpet of blue light all the way to the edge of heaven. 'This is the way things will be,' the moon whispered as I sat down with my back against the cabin. I must have gone to sleep sitting on the ground, for the next thing I knew, Mama was shaking me and it was dark and the moon had gone down. 'What are you doing out here?' Mama hissed as she pushed me inside. I was so sleepy and surprised, there was no answer. I could tell Mama was hot and covered with sweat, like she had been running or dancing, the way I'd seen her do at the revival meeting. Her turban had come undone, and she'd tied it around her shoulders. She smelled sweet like rotten fruit, the way the master smelled when he had been drinking brandy. 'I'll whip you in the morning,' Mama said. 'I'll teach you to mind me.' Mama got a dipper of water from the bucket in the corner and drank it, and then lay down on her cot. The worst thing about a whipping is having to wait for it. Mama knew that, and I knew that, and I guess Master Thomas knew it too, for he whipped one of the help from time to time when they didn't mind him. But that was a bigger thing, an awful thing, to see a man whip with a black snake whip till his back was cut and he was bleeding down to his feet. Mama might say, 'As a warning, I'm going to cut the blood out of you,' but she never did. She knew the worst part of punishment was the anticipation. The next morning, after we ate mush with molasses and I washed up the bowls, Mama said, 'You know what I need? Go get me that hickory.' It was a relief to finally go and get it over with. 'Better be a good switch or I whip you twice,' Mama said. Sad as it was to have to go after my own switch, there was a kind of dignity to it. All I had to do was get the hickory and bear the whipping and cry a little to make Mama feel I was sorry, and then it would be all right again. I couldn't stand for Mama to be mad at me. If Mama was mad at me, then the whole world seemed twisted to the side and empty. After I brought her the switch, Mama made me go outside. I had to stand in the yard where everybody could see the whipping. She made me hold her left hand with my left hand, and she whipped me on my legs and on my butt. The hickory stung my skin like a hot wire. 'How many times I have to tell you to mind me?' Mama said as she swung the switch. 'I do mind,' I said. 'Don't you sass me,' Mama said, and swung harder. 'I mind you, I mind you,' I said, and started to cry. 'You sass me, I cut the blood out of you,' Mama said. She was so busy whipping me, and my eyes were so full of tears, neither of us saw the master standing nearby, watching. His sleeves were rolled up like he was on the way to the field. When the crops needed tending, the master sometimes worked right alongside to help. 'Don't whip that girl. She didn't mean to do nothing wrong,' Master Thomas said.
Mama stepped back and dropped the hickory to her side. Angel's too pretty to whip, Master Thomas said. Her skin's too perfect and her face too pretty. What has she done? She don't mind me, Mama said. She sassed me. The master put his hand on my shoulder and looked in my eyes. I shivered at his touch, yet I was pleased by it at the same time. I could feel the power in his hand, which is not the power of muscles and calluses. Angel don't mean to be bad, Master Thomas said. Besides, she's almost a young woman. He looked me in the eyes and smiled, and I tried to smile back through my tears. Would you like to work in the big house? The master said. I think you're grown up enough to work in the big house. Would you like that? So that's when she moves into the big house and eventually becomes the bed warmer for her owner. But when she sees Jonah at the Jubilee, we would say hooks up with him at the Jubilee, she realizes that he is a runaway slave. And she thinks, if he can run away, maybe I can too. So she follows him. And he tries to get away from her several times because he thinks his chances of making it to the north are better if he's on his own and not with another escaped slave. So the plot is really an adventure story as they go up the Appalachian chain, and he leaves her four times, and she catches up with him each time. She simply will not be left. When he leaves her first on the French Broad River, she runs into the goat man. There really was a goat man, by the way. It was a tinker who went from the north to the south on an annual basis, repairing pots and pans and sharpening knives and scissors and that kind of thing. The goat man lets her travel with him. And they're going up through the valley of Virginia, up toward what would become Roanoke. It was called Big Lick at that time. But they're in the valley of Virginia, and she says, we came creaking over a hill and saw these cherry trees loaded down with black cherries and a woman on a short ladder picking the cherries. Now, the goat man and I thought the same thing. He had to get us some sweet cherries to eat on the way. We needed a change, and cherries were just the thing. So we stopped on the road, and I hollered to the woman to ask if she wanted any pots and pans mended or knives and scissors sharpened. She didn't hear me at first, and I yelled again. Only then did I see the baby lying on a blanket on the grass at the edge of the orchard. The baby was waving its legs and arms around and crying. I have scissors that need sharpening, the woman on the ladder called. Can you wait till I get to the house? How long will you be? I hollered. Now, for some reason, when I called, I looked up and saw this big bird out of the corner of my eye. I thought at first it must be a hawk, but then as it came closer, I saw it was a golden eagle. You don't expect to see a bird that spreads its wings so wide. And then it dove just like a hawk dropping on a chicken. And I screamed because it was going like a lightning bolt, straight for the baby. No, can't be, I hollered and started running toward the baby. I heard the whoosh of the wings, but I was too slow. That awful bird that looked like it was on fire swooped and grabbed the pretty baby in its claws. Its wings were longer than I was tall, and I could feel the wind off its wings as they beat to lift back up. But that baby must have been heavier than that devil bird expected, for it beat harder and blasted up dust from the weeds and slowly lifted away. It looked like I wasn't going to reach the baby in time, but the awful bird was slower than he meant to be, flogging and flapping his wings to carry off his prize. No, I yelled and grabbed the baby around its belly. No, you bastard, I screamed. The wings beat in my face and the eagle pulled away, but he couldn't lift the baby out of my grasp. Even the hell bird wasn't that strong. He yanked and beat my face and pecked the top of my head like a cold chisel, and I still didn't let go. I thought he was going to peck out my eyes, and I turned my face away, but didn't let go of the darling child. Now, the eagle had to make up his mind. He couldn't carry the baby off as long as I held her, and he wouldn't let go with his claws. His eyes glared at me like squirts of fire. He was as mad as a demon from hell. I jerked my head sideways, and he pecked my ear. His claws were dug into the baby's flesh, and I couldn't grab his foot because I was holding onto the baby's belly. I looked around to see if anybody could help me, but the goat man just stood by the wagon like he was frozen. And the woman had fallen off a ladder and was picking herself up in the weeds. For a second, I thought of trying to grab the eagle by the neck, but if I let go of the baby, he would fly away. He beat his wings more, and dust boiled up so I could hardly see, and the baby screamed. That devil was trying to see how determined I was, and when he saw I didn't aim to let go, he gave it up, took his claws out of the baby. But before he flew away, he slashed his claws on the side of my head, and I could feel the wet blood. That terrible bird flapped away, and I held the baby that wasn't hurt except for some claw marks. The woman ran up and grabbed the baby out of my hands, and she pressed it to her bosom. She laughed and cried at the same time, and then prayed, and then started to cry again. Several reviewers have called this novel a picaresque novel, a road novel, and it is an adventure story, terrible things happening, and some funny things. There are actually some comic relief in it here and there, but it's a story about these two in much greater danger than they even realize. I can remember working on this, I would find myself holding my breath, knowing just how much danger they were in at this particular time, 1851, because anybody could catch them, according to the fugitive slave law, and turn them in. They make their way all the way up to Winchester, Virginia, and then catch a train to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and work their way up the Susquehanna River. It's getting cold. Winter's coming on, and finally they make it all the way to Owego, New York. Now, there was a train that ran from Owego to Ithaca at that time, and they unloaded barges on the Susquehanna, put the cargo on the train, and took it to Ithaca. And of course, in Ithaca, they could load things on steamboats, and Ithaca was, connected to the Erie Canal, and therefore to the Midwest and to the Atlantic Ocean. So Ithaca was a very busy port at that time. When they get to Owego, Angel is exhausted, and she refuses to run and catch the train that is leaving for Ithaca, and he leaves her again for the fourth time, jumps on the train, and rides it all the way to Ithaca. He's never seen a place like that, the waterfalls, the big lake, but he's almost frozen when he falls off that train in Ithaca and goes looking for a place to warm up. Doesn't know anybody in this strange town. He doesn't even know how to pronounce the name Ithaca. At the corner of Aurora Street, Jonah came to a brick church with stained glass windows and found the door unlocked. It was mostly dark inside, but he saw benches and the light from the colored windows. Out of the wind, the air was warmer. As Jonah's eyes adjusted a little, he saw a stove at the side of the church near the altar. He walked toward the front and realized as he neared it that a fire was crackling in the stove. If the stove was lit, somebody must be in the church. "Hello and welcome," a voice said. Jonah spun around and saw a man in a shiny black robe emerge from a room behind the pulpit. "Hello, sir," Jonah said and took off his hat. "I just wanted to get warm." "I'm Timothy Ballew," the man in the robe said. "You are most welcome." Jonah was so surprised he couldn't think what to say. He couldn't claim to be a laborer on his way to work. It must be Sunday if a fire was roaring in the stove. "Make yourself at home," Reverend Ballew said. He was a short man with glasses and side whiskers. He didn't seem at all surprised to see Jonah. "We'll have worship service in about 20 minutes, the Reverend said. "You're very welcome to stay." "Thank you, sir," Jonah said. The minister looked at Jonah's boots and his coat, soiled with soot and ashes from the train. I keep coffee and biscuits in the back room to refresh me while I prepare my sermons, he said. Could I offer you something to nibble? Jonah knew it was impolite to accept, but he was too famished to refuse. Thank you, sir, he said, and bowed his head. Reverend Ballou led him to the little room piled with books and papers. Another black robe hung from a hook in the corner. A coffee pot sat on the hearth of a small fireplace where lazy flames beckoned and gestured. The preacher cleared a spot at the table and set a pot of biscuits and a cup of coffee before Jonah. Jonah sipped the coffee. He felt the hot liquid warm his belly and begin to spread through him. His bones ached with cold, and the warm coffee didn't touch the marrow at first. The biscuits were sweet as the sweetest cake. There was butter to spread on the biscuits, making them even sweeter. Mrs. Ballou, who was the organist, arrived and invited Jonah to stay for the service. She was taller than her husband, with dark hair, pale skin, and blue eyes. She invited Jonah to come to their house for dinner after the meeting. I hope you'll find friends in Ithaca, she said. Jonah finished the biscuits and coffee and returned to the meeting room. The room was already half filled with worshipers. Reverend Ballou sat in a chair behind the pulpit, and Mrs. Ballou began to play a quiet hymn on the organ. Jonah walked to the back of the church and sat on the last bench. Some of those entering in their fine Sunday clothes glanced at him and looked quickly away. An older woman smiled at him. Jonah knew he smelled bad after all the days on the road. He tried to gather himself into himself to keep his stink from spreading. As he watched the church fill, Jonah wondered how safe he was here, appearing in public at a service for everyone to see. There was no guarantee that Reverend Ballou, kind as he seemed, wouldn't report him to the sheriff if he knew Jonah was a runaway, and someone in the congregation might be suspicious of him and inform the authorities. But as he warmed up, filled with coffee and biscuits and butter, Jonah felt heavier and heavier. He had walked many miles, and he had not slept much the night before. As soon as the Reverend Ballou stood up and announced his first hymn, and the congregation began to sing, Jonah was already asleep. He dreamed about cliffs and waterfalls and sparkling lakes. It was only after the church was empty that Reverend Ballou woke him. Service is over, the preacher said and shook his shoulder. I can see how rousing my sermon was. The preacher laughed, and Jonah woke to his laughter. I'm sorry, sir, Jonah mumbled. No need to apologize, the minister said. Perhaps you needed sleep more than a sermon. Jonah had slept so deeply in the warm church, he was befuddled. It took him a minute to understand Reverend Ballou's questions. Yes, sir, Jonah murmured as if he was about to go back to sleep. Well, I have just one question, really, Reverend Ballou said. Have you killed anybody? Jonah woke and looked the preacher in the eye. No, sir, he said. I never killed anybody. It happens that this Reverend Ballou is an abolitionist, and he has a printing press in the basement of his house where he can print a credible document of manumission. An angel then shows up in Ithaca. I won't give away the ending, but they think they might be safe for a while. I'm told that most of the African-American community left Ithaca after the fugitive slave law was passed and did flee to Canada. So there are not a lot of other African-Americans in Ithaca when they arrive. But I will stop there. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you. I understand question and answer are part of this series. If you have questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. My students will tell you, if you give me a pulpit, I can talk a long time about writing and literature. Yes?
When Jonah wet his pants, did they have jeans?
1851? They had pants made out of what was called jean cloth. It's a very old word. It comes from Genoa cloth. It goes back to, I think, the 16th century. But they made heavy work clothes out of jean cloth. And then our blue jeans come from that. That's probably what he had, a shirt made out of homespun, very likely. I always loved that. Genoa cloth as a denim, as denim from Nîmes, France. Calicoes from India. Other questions? Have I answered all your questions? Yes, way back there. The question is, did I get any guidance from a publisher or editor about writing in dialect? My first editor, Shannon Ravenel, a great editor, worked with me on all the other novels, loved that dialect, the use of dialect. We worked a long time going back and forth on it. Then she retired and the new editor came on, and he's the one who said, I think that'll be difficult for people. It will distance the character. It'd be hard to read for them. And he persuaded me that was true. So that's when I completely rewrote Angel's sections. Angel becomes Sarepta in Ithaca. They change the name. And Jonah becomes Joshua because Joshua made it to the Promised Land. And he goes in the spring up on the hill, East Hill here, and finds an oak tree and puts a big stone under it. In the Bible, Joshua planted the witness stone. Remember that in the Old Testament? To remind him of his journey to the Promised Land. It was fun to do that sort of thing. Yeah.
So it was more a literary
thing to not write in dialect rather than a choice that you made. Well, we decided that dialect is out of fashion in any case. I mean, it would be very hard to publish the kind of novels as like Faulkner did, or, you know, even Huckleberry Finn. Young people don't like to read it, for one thing. I decided that, yes, it would distance my character. I wanted that character to be absolutely transparent. You're with her. You're thinking, and you're not worrying about, you know, well, what does this mean? Or, you know, or how funny she talks or anything like that. I mean, it was hard to do because I'd worked so long on that. My other novels have been in dialect, or many of them. Very light dialect, by the way. It's a trick. You give people a taste of dialect. You know, Gap Creek is mostly in very straight English, but people have the impression, because the double negatives and I've seen this, and people feel it's in dialect, though of course it's not. Any linguist can spot it very quickly as mostly correct English. And the spelling is always modern. That's an idea I think I got from Eudora Welty. You just give people a taste of dialect. They feel they're hearing it. Though of course they're not. You don't want them to stop and, you know, have to look up in a glossary or something. Other questions? Yes. The question is, what kind of advice do I have for aspiring young writers? Basically one word, persistence. Because I've been teaching so long, I know that everybody has talent, and some people have a lot of talent, but the people who succeed are not necessarily the people who seem to have the most talent. The people who succeed as writers are those who just keep at it, and keep at it, and keep at it. You know, the day after their novel's rejected, or they lose their agent, or whatever, you know, they go back and start revising it. Those are the people who win. I don't know what that is, you know, the fire in the belly, is it madness, craziness? It's true of all the arts. I mean, the people who succeed are the people who just simply keep doing it. They won't stop. They won't let anything stop them. And that's about the best advice you can give, because everybody learns to write in their own way, and you can't teach it. You can coach writers, but you can't teach them. Because they're doing their writing, you know, and it really is closer to athletics, perhaps, than teaching physics or history or something, where you're imparting a body of knowledge. An art is learned by doing it, and you can
encourage, you can give some pointers to writers, but you can't teach them to write. They have to teach themselves. Yes?
Uh-huh.
Oh. Well, you might ask. she feels he's her only hope. And she feels that he really does love her, as it turns out to be. But I thought of it from the very beginning as an adventure story. And they do have much trouble and run into a lot of cruelty. But they do make it finally. Of course, we don't know finally how safe they are. I mean, we don't know that this is, you know, they're safe forever. It ends on a note that has a question implied in it.
To be continued?
Possibly. I've thought of that. But yeah, it is the kind of novel called a picaresque novel, an adventure novel. Though there's a lot of cruelty in it, there's also some humor, and things turn out for them. Yes?
Reverend Ballou, historical?
No, there were such ministers around, but he's fiction. Yes?
Well, how much research did you do for this, or was it all just from your own experience?
I certainly read some histories of this part of New York and consulted historians like Carol Kamen and others. I had done a lot of research about that route, the Valley of Virginia, in other books, in the Daniel Boone book and in the Lions of the West, and a lot of research in the 19th century, the frontier and the backwoods of the Appalachian Mountains and Virginia and North Carolina. So a lot of that fed into it. The details about farming and things are mostly based on my own experience. I grew up in that area and did a lot of those things. So mostly imagination. It's a work of fiction. It's not a work of history. The work I'm working on now is certainly a work of history. So I spent the last several months just checking footnotes and spellings and stuff like that. One more question? Yes?
How old are the, I might have mentioned it, mm-hmm. forgive me if I didn't catch mm-hmm. it, but how old are the characters? And also, have you ever were interested in writing something on Native American history?
He is 18 and she's 1 year older than that. And I have done so much research on Native American history, I could bore you for hours and hours and hours about the Sioux most recently, since I'm writing about Custer and Custer's widow and the Sioux. But my research on American Indians began with the Cherokees in that area where I grew up. And the Shawnees for the Daniel Boone biography, Shawnees and Iroquois. It's one of my favorite subjects. I've made a point in this new book and in the Boone book of pointing out the influence of Native culture on the American Revolution, something I've never seen another historian talk about. The consensus political structure of American Indians rubbed off on the revolutionaries. I think it had a real influence on it. And most recently, I've become very interested in the influence of Indian oratory and preaching on revival preaching. Tremendous preachers of the 19th century, like Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, Tecumseh. And so many of the great revival preachers I heard as a kid were Indian and part Indian, people like Oral Roberts, Jimmy Lee Swaggart, Charles Jessup, that sort of thing. Yeah, it is one of the subjects I am most fascinated by. Also the influence of Native music on American music. Especially interesting to me, and unacknowledged for the most part. I mean, you talk about the African influence, the Scotch-Irish, British Isles, that sort of thing, but people rarely mention the impact of Native music on American music.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, that wasn't only, you know, white versus Indian, but also Indian versus Indian, as it always was. I mean, all the battles, there were Indians fighting Indians, and you're absolutely right. The Cherokees were wealthy people where they were in the mountains. They were traders and farmers, as well as hunters and warriors, and they became even wealthier out in Oklahoma, not only because of oil, but because of their great herds of horses and cattle and their extensive ownings of African slaves. I mean, the chiefs who went out to Oklahoma built houses that looked like something from Gone with the Wind. Chief Ulitika of the Hiawassee Cherokees, very wealthy. It's a complex story, I assure you, a very complicated story. My character, the first character I'm writing about in the new book, Nancy Ward, Nanyahai, was rewarded when she became war woman by being given African slaves in 1755.
Yeah, they mentioned that on the news tonight on the BBC, something about, so I didn't catch it. I didn't catch it quite. But anyway, thank you for answering my question.
Yeah. Oh, I could talk a long time. Thank you all very much. It's been a great audience. Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.